Shepard, please go ahead.
Your Honor, I may please the court. Good morning, and let me first start by wishing everybody the best of safety and health in these difficult times. And I also just want to quickly express my gratitude to the court and to all of the people on this call, most of whom are public servants, for your service during this time to keep the wheels of justice turning. I know as an attorney, I genuinely appreciate it. So I'm going to first address the question of retroactivity, and then I'll move on and talk about the harmless error issue that's been discussed earlier today with regard to GEP. So first, on the question of retroactivity, I don't think that there's any question about how clearly this court spoke in JLG. It said that CSAAS, quote, does not enjoy general acceptance within the scientific community. And based upon that, it said that it could not be considered, quote unquote, reliable evidence. This was a little understated as compared to the special master whose report the Supreme Court, this court affirmed, which said that CSAAS testimony was, quote, misleading and unreliable, and that it was based on, quote, a glaring lack of data. Based upon this, the only choices that this court has is between complete retroactivity, which would be appropriate if it were to overcome an aspect of the criminal trial that substantially impairs the truth-finding function, or pipeline retroactivity, which is that the decision's purpose was to enhance the reliability of the fact-finding process. At the very least, it's that. And in terms of just standing and my own client's purposes, and in fact, for all of the people, the defendants that are on this call, pipeline retroactivity is all that we argued in the appellate division, and really all we can argue here. Ms. Borden will argue for the ACLU for broader relief, but in terms of our clients getting the retroactive benefit of the JLG opinion, pipeline retroactivity is the most that we would need. I would like to pick up on a point that Justice LaVecchia, though, said earlier in discussing a slightly different point in the harmless error context, which is this is a unique situation in some ways, in that even pipeline retroactivity to a certain common sense extent understates where our clients are. My client was sentenced 9 months after JLG himself was sentenced. And it's just a matter of the greatest arbitrariness that it was not his decision that became the vehicle for this court's decision in JLG. After all, as has been pointed out, he raised precisely the same issue at trial. And one of the points that this court has repeatedly made in its jurisprudence with regard to retroactivity is that a determination as to retroactivity should be just and consonant with public policy. And justice, respectfully, would frown upon the arbitrariness of not giving my client, just because of the happenstance of the timing of his case, to not be given the retroactive effect of JLG. But you don't have to go there, because after all, he was in the pipeline, and pipeline retroactivity is at least what's appropriate, given that the purpose of the JLG decision was, again, at the very least, to enhance the reliability of the fact-finding process. Of course, if you, and let me also just say, just interrupt myself and say, you all should feel free to interrupt me at any time. I never reserve 5 minutes because I'd rather respond to whatever concerns you might have, but I'll keep going until you do. In any event, of course, that prong one, which is what the purposes of the underlying decision here, JLG, was, is only the first step of the inquiry to the extent that we're dealing with enhancement of the reliability of the fact-finding process. If we're dealing with the notion that there was an aspect of the criminal trial that substantially impaired truth-finding function, it's not at all clear from this court's jurisprudence that you even reach prongs two and three. But again, I'll leave that for Ms. Borden. With regard to pipeline retroactivity, one then turns to the second and third prongs of the analysis. And those second and third prongs, I think, are make 100% clear that in this case, at least pipeline retroactivity is appropriate. With regard to the second prong, which is the, and let me actually back up and just say one other thing first. Ms. Leonard, in her discussion with the court this morning, analogized this case to Henderson and talked about how the purely prospective application of the rule as in Henderson was appropriate here. Respectfully, that's simply incorrect and misreads a huge aspect of Henderson and a gigantic distinction between this case and Henderson. So in Henderson, of course, a great deal of the rationale for the court's opinion was a prophylactic one. It was teaching law enforcement what they should and should not do in the future and threatening that if they did not do what they were supposed to do in the future, that evidence would be, this court's word, suppressed. That sort of exclusionary rule is the classic type of rule as to which retroactive application is typically not afforded. So this case is fundamentally different from Henderson in that way, but it's also fundamentally different from Henderson in another, even more important way, which is the disruption to the system of justice, prong three of the retroactivity analysis. In Henderson, there would have been literally thousands, who knows, maybe tens of thousands of cases that would have been affected if we went back and retroactively reviewed every single eyewitness identification. Here, for pipeline retroactivity, which again is what I am advocating for, we have somewhere, we learned today, between 23 and what was originally 40 cases. Respectfully, I think that the right number for the court to consider is the number that the state has set forth today, which is the 23. I don't mean to skew this. I mean, they were clear, Ms. Leonard was clear that that's just an approximation. Either way, we are not dealing here with thousands of cases, nor even are we dealing with hundreds of cases, even close, that are in the pipeline, which was the number that was used by the court in Lark, even as it afforded pipeline retroactivity. Here's what pipeline retroactivity is appropriate for. It's appropriate for cases in which there's really a finite number of cases where there's not going to be such a disruption to the system. And I do agree that that part of that analysis is not just as my colleagues on the other side say, a matter of arithmetic. It's also a matter of the burdens on prosecutors, on victims. All of that should and really must be considered. But this court has been clear that in engaging in that inquiry, one of the most important things it must consider is doing justice, is making sure that defendants are afforded their rights, that reliable fact-finding takes place. And there's really no question in the retroactivity context here that the purpose of the JLG rule was to enhance the reliability of fact-finding. It found, after years of whittling down its own decision in JQ and making clear that there were great limitations on the way in which CSAAS testimony was to be used, was to be presented, and could be argued, including what jury instructions ought to be provided, that the time had come to put an end to what the special master called the use of junk science. It was an important decision, not only because of the particular cases at issue here, but also because we all understand that this testimony was coming in through experts, and we understand the unique way in which expert testimony is considered by juries and viewed in the fact-finding process. That is, it tends to be given greater weight. So in that regard, there's really no doubt that what was going on here was trying to make our system a more just one, a more fair one for criminal defendants, with the attendant costs for a relatively few number of cases. And I say that with all due respect, 40 is some, but 40 is within the numbers, and we've cited cases, I think it was Knight, where there were 39 cases. There are cases where there's 11, but even in Lark, where it said there are hundreds, at least pipeline retroactivity should be afforded. I will also say one other thing, which is in cases, and this court spoke very clearly about this in the Feel case, it said where there's doubt, where there's an insufficient amount of data as to the number of cases that would be affected, at the very least, pipeline retroactivity should be afforded. So for all those reasons and those set forth in the appellate division's decision, we would respectfully request that the very least that ought to be done here is that pipeline retroactivity should be afforded, especially to these defendants who could have themselves been the beneficiaries of the JOG decision, other than the real happenstance of the fact that they just missed. Now, of course, that means they're in the pipeline, but they were really at the end of the pipeline, right where it spills out into court decisions, and they should be treated accordingly in the interest of justice. So I'll stop there with regard to retroactivity unless the court has any questions.
Anyone have any questions on retroactivity? Mr. Lesberg, I have a concern about harmless error in this case in particular. Your client is convicted of aggravated sexual assault, and in addition to the victim's testimony, we have the physical evidence from the search, and we have the intercept that Mr. McNamara spoke about. I want to ask you to address several passages that I'll highlight first in the context of harmless error. From the intercept, the victim says early on, "The most intense romantic and intense sexual experience I ever had was like from 8 to 16, and like now, I can't find it, you know." And the defendant's answer is not, "What are you talking about?" Instead, he says, "I know about it. Yep." And then a little bit later, the victim says, "Were you being honest when you felt like we were soulmates?" Answer, "Yep." Question, "Or did you feel like it was just sexual?" And then the defendant responds, "No, I did. I absolutely did. And I still do," skipping down. "It was just like a white hot thing. There was no turning. There's no going back to that level." Skipping again, "There's no way to even hold a candle to it. It's just like something remarkable to me." And one final passage, not long after, the victim says, "Just a reassurance to know, like, that it wasn't just sex, that you really loved me." Answer, "Oh my God," the victim again, "because I don't feel like anybody has ever loved me like that before, you know." And the defendant says, "I understand. I know what you mean." In light of these quite focused passages and the physical evidence that appears to be corroborative, how is this not a case of harmless error?
Let me answer that in two ways. And believe me, the first way is not does not mean to deflect at all. I'd like to begin by just talking about what harmless error really is and isn't, because I think that those principles have to be brought to bear in deciding on the harmless error inquiry. Let's remember, Your Honor, what harmless error is. It's a doctrine whereby the judicial system forgives errors that are committed below because it holds they wouldn't have mattered to the result. The standard for harmless error is, and really should be accordingly, a high one, whether it's constitutional or not. I don't disagree with my friend Mr. McNamara's recitation of what that standard is. The standard is that there has to be some degree of possibility that the error here, the introduction of the CSAAS testimony, led to an unjust result. Some possibility. And that this court, in discussing harmless error in JLG, also talked about the possibility as the standard. One other fundamental point that I'd like to make before moving on to very directly address Your Honor's questions, Chief Justice. The question, there's another aspect of harmless error that has to be built into this court's consideration of whether the error is harmless. And that is that part of the problem here, and in these CSAAS cases, is always the sufficiency, the jury instructions. This court in JLG struck down the existing jury instructions. Those were the instructions that were provided in GEP. And this court, in a series of cases, and we've cited those, I believe, in our papers, has held that flawed jury instructions are, quote, almost always considered prejudicial, that they're essential for a fair trial, that they're presumed to be reversible as opposed to harmless, that they are, in Vic, quoting Simon, poor candidates for rehabilitation under the harmless error philosophy. In other words, harmless error is not to be adduced lightly. And it shouldn't be here. And it wasn't.
But Mr. Lusbury, there's a distinction, is there not, between a case where the issue is a flawed jury instruction, and that is the issue that causes the error, and a case like this where the issue really fundamentally was expert testimony, which the court has now said is not sufficient, really reliable, except in one aspect under Rule 702. The jury instruction piece of that followed the exclusion of the evidence. Would you agree with me on that?
It certainly followed from it, but it was an important part of it, because what was critical in this case, Justice Patterson, was that both the evidence that was adduced from the same Dr. Durso as in JLG and the jury instruction emphasized a critical aspect that put the thumb on the scales of making the credibility determination between the defendant on the one hand and the victim on the other. This case was a he said, she said case. That's not my language, that's the language of the trial judge. It was a case where the credibility of the victim was the linchpin, as the appellate division said. This was fundamentally a credibility contest. I'm going to get, I promise, Chief Justice, to your question that goes to the
Mr. Lusbert, I think you need to get there now. We understand the principles. Yep. We discussed in JLG a case where the error was, of course, highlighted and direction was given. And notwithstanding that, because of the overwhelming evidence in JLG, the court found harmless error.
Right.
We have very express passages here that seem to incriminate strongly. Why is this not harmless error in light of that?
Because it's exactly what happened here did not happen in JLG, which was in this case, the defendant, Mr. Parker, got on the stand and with respect to each of those passages was asked to explain it and did explain it. Now, I understand that this court may choose to think that those explanations are not satisfying. I understand that it may be that the jury disbelieved them there. We don't know. And the reason we don't know is because the jury made the decision about whether to believe or to disbelieve GEP's explanations based upon a flawed jury instruction and evidence which specifically enhanced the notion that they would find the one side, that is the victim, reliable and credible and the defendant not to be. That's the answer fundamentally to your question. Each of the passages, Chief Justice, that you've pointed out, each one of them was specifically discussed on the GEP's direct examination. In each case, he addressed them. He was subject to cross-examination. And at the end of the day, he denied that he had had sexual relations with the victim when she was a juvenile, and that the only sexual contact that they had been this necking episode after she was already an adult. So the answer to your question very directly is that this is so easily distinguished from JLG. In JLG, you will recall, there was a tape as well. That was a tape in which the defendant had made specific statements offering to pay the victim to retract her accusations. In that case, though, the defendant did not take the stand, did not deny or explain those. And here, again, you may choose not to accept, you may not believe those explanations. But it's not for this court, respectfully, to make that determination. The issue is whether a jury properly instructed, and in particular, not told to overweight the testimony of the victim might possibly believe the defendant's explanation of things. Let me take the white hot statement just as an example to be very concrete. That white hot statement he explained was a phrase that was used by him and others when he was living in Australia, and it means something like the way we use the word awesome today. And it was describing their relationship, not their not, you know, necessarily a sexual thing. I understand Mr. McNamara says anybody listening today would think white hot refers to sex. But what he explained, and one, you may or may not believe it, I may or may not believe it. That's not the point. The point is whether a properly instructed jury would believe it. A jury that was not instructed to, or was not told by expert testimony, that inconsistencies in the victim's testimony, which went directly to her credibility, and there are numerous, and we point them out in our papers, I'm happy to review them, but that inconsistencies in her testimony should be excused, because inconsistencies are one of the things that go along with the child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome. It's one of those five features of it. So that's the problem. The fundamental problem here is that very much unlike JLG, with regard to each of the passages that you discussed, the explanation, which might come across as sounding silly to us now, was one that turned on his credibility. And by the way, this was a situation in which the victim's credibility coming forward those many years later, and in particular coming forward years and years after she had already become an adult, which was, as you may recall, one of the issues that had been raised at the trial as to whether CSAS was even applicable to a situation in which a lot of the delay had occurred during the time of majority. But in which her testimony was subject to vigorous attack on the grounds of inconsistencies. Those inconsistencies are at the heart of whether she should or should not have been believed, and therefore at the heart of whether GEP's explanations of those quotes, as opposed to hers, should or should not be believed. In order to do justice in this case, all of that should have been presented to the jury, and the jury should have had the opportunity to assess his credibility with regard to those things, with regard to all of it, as well as with regard to the underlying facts, so that a fair determination can be made without the benefit of testimony, expert testimony, and an ensuing jury charge that, in essence, put its thumb on the scales with regard to that very credibility finding. That is the issue in this case. It was the issue that, yes, the appellate division addressed it fairly briefly, but it's what they meant when they said that her credibility was the linchpin of the case. And in a lot of ways, that's it. Let me just address one other thing that you raised briefly, Chief Justice, which was the evidence that was recovered afterwards. Mr. McNamara was candid with the court, as I know he always is, and pointed out that a lot of that testimony was not stuff that she brought to the attention of law enforcement until after it was shown to her. She had related certain other facts. But keep in mind that this is what was recovered was material that was that happened years and years after the events in question here, and it gave rise to a somewhat different explanation of what had occurred than what she had said before. Why does that matter? It only matters. This is not meant to besmirch her or to undermine what the significance of that evidence might be if it were properly presented. But the extent to which that evidence is probative goes to whether a harmless error, to the way the harmless error analysis is conducted, goes to whether this, so essentially, you're using the word corroborate. How corroborative, how powerfully corroborative that is, depends on measuring GEP's credibility versus that of the victim. And it's there that there was not a fair assessment based upon the CSAAS testimony on the one hand and the jury instruction on the other.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Lusberg?
I just have one. Mr. Lusberg, you're not suggesting that a harmless error analysis would not apply when the evidence comes down to a credibility contest, or would you?
Let me just say this. It might have been that if I were deciding JLG in the first place, I might have argued to my colleagues on the bench that this CSAAS testimony is so devastating in every case that you don't need harmless error analysis at all. But this court obviously did not reach that conclusion. and it did apply a harmless error analysis. And of course, as an advocate, I am bound by that. What I would say is that in making the decision about whether that harmless error analysis in that case, I mean, is like the quote-unquote corroborative evidence in this case, I would respectfully request that you carefully compare those two types of evidence. I've already mentioned that there was a tape in that case that was that's very different than this one. There was also a recording in that case of the actual self and the actual sexual encounter that we did not have.
That's not the question I asked you. So let me be more pointed, and I'll put this more in the form of a hypothetical. Let's say there is a credibility contest, but the defendant's version is totally incredible. How would harmless error work in those circumstance?
I imagine that there might be a situation in which the defendant's explanations were so incredible that they would be given no weight in the harmless error analysis. I can imagine that that's the case. Respectfully, that's not the situation here. And you never had to reach that question, of course, in JLG, because in JLG, the defendant didn't testify. But here, the defendant did testify. He didn't deny that which was of record. He attempted to explain it. I respectfully don't think that any of us is in a position to judge the appropriateness, correctness of those explanations. I don't think those explanations could be deemed harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in the constitutional sense, or that they would give rise to no possibility that the way in which the jury was thereafter instructed based on the CSAAS testimony made it less likely that they would be believed. So yes,
are you saying
harmless error analysis matters?
Are you saying the court must give credit to the defendant's explanations by telling us that we're in no position to analyze them?
No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that where there are competing explanations of what specific phrases meant, in a situation in which one of the parties' credibility has been attacked, where evidence comes in that shouldn't have come in, that bolstered the credibility of one side or the other, improperly, this court has now held, that harmlessness is going to be very difficult to find. I could imagine facts, for example, where a defendant said, this happened on a Tuesday, and it's clear that it happened on a Monday. If that's the case, of course the court doesn't have to credit it. But here, what we have is a defendant who is giving cogent, albeit you may not believe them, but cogent explanations. And those should have been put to the jury, just as the rest of his explanation of what occurred should have gone to the jury, bereft of a jury instruction that essentially tilted the scales in a way that made it almost impossible for him to prevail.
My last question, Mr. Lusberg, do you agree with Mr. McNamara that there's no difference in the harmless error analysis with or without an objection?
I do. I do. As a matter of just fundamentally my understanding of plain error versus harmless error is that those are two different inquiries. I think that's what Mr. McNamara was saying, and I agree with him about that. What I would say, though, and this is, I think, important, is this. This court has said, with respect to both plain error and harmless error, a specific doctrinal point, which is that neither are good candidates for rehabilitation with regard to jury instructions. So that is to say, even an unobjected to jury instruction cannot be rehabilitated through plain error, and even an objected to jury instruction cannot be rehabilitated through harmless error. And respectfully, I think that the jury instructions are a huge part of the CSAAS analysis. That's what this court held in JLG. And to divorce it and say this was just about the expert testimony, respectfully, brings up short what the full impact of that important decision was.
Thank you, Mr. Lusberg.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Watson.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I just like to note that my video is frozen, but I can hear everyone well, so I'll just proceed. I'd like to waive my preliminary statement and just rely on the arguments of Mr. Lesberg as it relates to retroactivity. I'm going to confine my argument to the harmless error issue in this case. And before I begin that analysis, I just want to make clear that what we're talking about here is not just the violation of an evidentiary rule. This is about a due process violation. In all of these cases, there was unreliable and incompetent evidence that was admitted at trial. And from State versus Michaels, we know that competent and reliable evidence remains the foundation of a fair trial, which ultimately seeks to determine the truth about criminal culpability. So I just don't want to minimize the impact of the error at issue here. I would ask confirm the appellate division's decision reversing defendant's conviction, finding that the admission of the CSAS testimony prejudices his right to a fair trial. And I'd like to, there are three reasons in support of the appellate division's decision. First, this is a case that rested on the credibility of a single witness, the complainant. He ended her testimony and maintained that recantation through two separate attorneys who were not involved in this case. And there is no dispute that this case comes down to the victim's credibility. The prosecutor in summation, he said, the victim admittedly is the majority of our case. There is a well-developed body of case law in New Jersey that says that when the state's case rests on the credibility of witness testimony, and here that's a single witness, not an objective physical evidence, the state's proofs are not overwhelming. And errors that tip the credibility scale in favor of the state generally not harmless, and that's what we have in this case. We don't have any physical evidence. We don't have any search recordings, as in JLG or consensual intercepts. There are no witnesses to corroborate the victim's account of abuse, and there are no admissions of guilt from defendant. We have a single witness who alleged a serious conduct took place, and that was the issue before the jury. Now, the error here was admitting this testimony, and that testimony had the effect of bolstering the victim's credibility. And we know that the statements that Dr. Derso provided to the jury, they're just lacking a scientific foundation. So even if we assume that the jury complied with the instructions limiting the use of the CSAS testimony, it basically validated all of the actions of the victim as behavior that may be consistent with abuse. And I'd just like to highlight the portion of the state summation again, where it makes very clear that this is a case that comes down to credibility coupled with CSAAS. The prosecutor told the jury, in addition, ladies and gentlemen, the victim's testimony at trial is competent evidence, I submit to you, to support a conviction coupled with the understanding of a child sex abuse accommodation syndrome. These are the two main pillars of the state's case, and the way that this testimony was used in closing was to smooth over some of the problems. Of course, we had the recantation in this case, which was a big deal for the state, and again, the prosecutor referred the jury to the CSAS testimony, told the jury that testimony addressed the fact that recantation is a common phenomenon. He mentioned it a second time, and we brought testimony in the form of expert opinion to explain how in child sex abuse, that is not uncommon. This is a rather dynamic and phenomenon that occurs uniquely in child sex matters. And we now know from the JLG opinion that this is not true. Experts don't agree about the frequency, and in fact, there is evidence that there is a low rate of recantation for truthful allegations. And again, on the last point, there were many inconsistencies in testimony that the defense counsel brought out closing, and the prosecutor returned to CSAS to smooth that over. He told the jury, you know, when you consider Dr. Durst's testimony about the age of the child, the experiences she's had, is it expected that perhaps some of this abuse she would forget? So this CSA's testimony was not a fleeting component of the case. It was something that was heavily relied on the state to prove its to meet its burden along with the victim's testimony. And my third point is that even if we the CSA's testimony as it was admitted in this case violated pre-JLG law, because Dr. Dirser directly opined on the attributes of the victim in this case, which is essentially providing an opinion on the truthfulness of her allegations. And we know that was a clear violation of from State versus RB. There are a number of instances in my brief where it had gone through, and I have highlighted areas where the prosecutor asked Dr. Dirso to basically address specific symptoms that the victim said that she had experienced, and asked if that was consistent with child sex abuse. And then on the issue of recantation, which was a big problem in this case, because Dr. Dirso testified that recantation commonly occurs when the victim feels ostracized or when she doesn't have a proper support system, and that may lead her to recant allegations. Those weren't the circumstances that existed in this case. So what the prosecutor did is he asked a leading question that incorporated all of the facts of this, of the case at issue, and said, how can you explain recantation under those circumstances? If you have a child who discloses to a non-offended parent and receives what appears to be a supportive response, many months later, is it possible that the experience of the system, yada, yada, can have a bearing on the ultimate recantation? Those facts precisely track what happened in this case. And of course, Dr. Dirso said, like, sure, that is possible. Sometimes children can be overwhelmed by the system. So it's essentially validating the recantation in this case, which was particularly problematic. So Dr. Dirso tailored his opinion to the facts of this case. His testimony was not theoretical or hypothetical, and there was no pretense in him testifying that he wasn't directly opining on the victim's allegations. But he has spent a lot of time discussing the fact that there was this instruction which told the jury that this is not supposed to help differentiate between children who have been abused and who haven't been abused, but that instruction would have been undermined by all of his testimony that is incorporating the facts of this case and asking the expert for an opinion on that. So because the victim's credibility was determinative of the outcome of the trial, and because the testimony had the effect of bolstering her credibility, defendant was denied a fair trial and the appellate division's decision should be affirmed.
Questions, anyone, for Ms. Watson? Thank you. Ms. Smith.
Good morning, Justices. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you for the opportunity to remote in. I represent CP. I'll confine my argument to the harmless error aspect of the case. In CP, the state indicates that the fact that there was two trials should be disregarded. In the first trial, the case was hung. The case was retried, and the only difference in the second case was the fact that there was an expert produced by the state for the purpose of the CSAAS testimony. Now, obviously, we can't get into the heads of the jurors to determine whether or not that was the deciding factor, but I don't think that this court or anybody else can minimize the fact that when you review the transcripts from both trials, that was the only difference in the two cases. So going into the analysis of the harmless error argument, I do think that has to be kept in the forefront of the court's mind.
How can we do that? How can we rely on anything from the first trial? It could have been 11 jurors for conviction. It could have been 11 jurors for acquittal. Isn't it our purpose really to focus on the fairness of the second trial?
Absolutely, but I do think that it is suspect that in the first trial, there was a hung jury, and really the only difference in the second trial was the introduction of that expert. I'm not saying that was the deciding factor, but I do think that it is suspect. When you take a look at and focusing on the second case, when you look at the evidence that was presented, this was a classic case of credibility. There was no other corroborating evidence submitted whatsoever. There was no physical evidence. There were no taped interviews. There was no DNA evidence that was submitted. All the evidence came strictly and exclusively from the complainant herself. The state indicates that this was overwhelming evidence, but the evidence all came from the complainant. And the evidence was in between not only the two trials, when you put the two transcripts back to back, but within the same trial, the testimony was inconsistent. And even though the defendant himself did not take the stand, the defendant produced witnesses so that even though I'm submitting that this was a credibility argument, the credibility can come from other witnesses. You can still have a credibility argument because evidence comes from all sorts of forms, whether it's from her mouth or physical evidence, and in this case, it was just her testimony. So I think for the state to indicate that this was overwhelming evidence, there was no other corroborating evidence that was put before the jury. It was strictly her testimony. And when, so the state's expert was Dr. Littman. Dr. Littman testified, putting JLG aside for a moment, when you look at the history of the CSAAS cases that have, that provided the scope in which this particular expert could testify, she went outside her bounds, which raised considerable objections by the trial attorney. There were, there were percentages that were discussed. The expert qualified and quantitated the testimony. The expert indicated to the jury that and justified the inconsistencies. And when defense counsel objected and sought out curative instructions, the trial court only engaged in a dialogue with the expert. No curative instructions were forthcoming. The only charge that was given with respect to this expert came days later. I think it was, if I'm correct, it was 5 days after the fact, and it was a very general charge. It was a modified jury charge, but it was a general charge as to how the jury could use the expert testimony. But it never addressed the improper testimony that was utilized by the state's expert. So when you have a credibility argument such as this one between the complainant with no other corroboration and the defendant, and that again can come from all sorts of witnesses, there's no question in CP that expert tipped the balance in favor of a conviction, because the expert went outside the scope of RB and WB and JR, which was already existing case law, not even addressing the newest case, JLB. And certainly this case is very distinguishable from JLB because you don't have these explicit threats. You don't have where there's a gun. You don't have these recorded sessions. You don't have a confession. You don't have any of that in CP. In CP, you only have the complainant's testimony, which is sorely inconsistent between two different trials, which were close in time, and within the trial itself. And if you look at, again, and I will rely on my colleague's recitation of the standard, but if there's any possibility that the expert could have tipped the balancing act, the balancing standard in favor of a conviction, then certainly CP did not receive a fair and unbiased trial by virtue of Dr. Lippman testifying. And certainly, when you look at how the trial court addressed the curative instruction as well as the jury charge, it was several witnesses after the fact and didn't exclusively address what occurred in the testimony. And certainly the timeliness of the charge and the failure to provide a curative instruction caused, I believe, irreparable prejudice to the defendant.
Questions, anyone? I think we have your position. Anything you'd like to add in closing?
No, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. Mr. Vanjura.
May it please the court. I'd like to focus my argument on why reversal should be ordered in CK's case, irrespective of this court's ultimate determination on retroactivity. In CK's case, Dr. Lippman's CSAS testimony played a central role. The only evidence against the defendant was Julie's accusation. There was no physical evidence, no eyewitness, no corroborating evidence at all. In fact, the only physical evidence in the case was the physical examination of Julie's vagina, which showed that Julie had an intact hymen. That severely undercut her accusation of repeated penile and digital penetration of her vagina. But inexplicably, the trial court failed to provide the model CSAS instruction to the jury. The jury wasn't told that CSAS is not a diagnostic device, that it cannot determine whether abuse occurred, and that it cannot be used to determine whether Julie was truthful. So there's a very high likelihood that the jury believed Julie because of the CSAS testimony. Without the CSAS model charge, the jury was free to believe that Dr. Lippman's testimony was substantive evidence of defendant's guilt, that Julie was telling the truth. This, standing alone, is plain reversible error. I respectfully submit that this court doesn't need to go any further in its analysis of CK's case, whether or not JLG applied here. If JLG does apply to CK's case, the need for reversal is clearer still. Dr. Lippman's testimony was a major portion of the state's case. She gave a full account of all the facts of CSAS, she vouched for the validity of CSAS, and she tailored her testimony to Julie's alleged learning difficulties. Lippman's testimony filled 30 transcript pages, going way beyond the delayed disclosure allowed by this court in narrow circumstances. Those circumstances are when the victim cannot provide a rational explanation for the delay. That exception doesn't apply to CK's case for two reasons. First, Julie did not delay disclosure. She testified that she told her friend Marisala about the abuse when it occurred in Lindenwald in 2010 or 2011. Second, at trial, she was 17 years old. She was perfectly capable of expressing herself. She testified that she was too scared to speak out. That was a fairly obvious rational explanation for any purported delay. So none of the CSAS testimony should have been admitted, not even on the narrow issue of delayed disclosure. So I respectfully disagree with Ms. Leonard that a retrial would be identical. I think a retrial would be a very different animal the next time around. I also disagree with Ms. Leonard about the general expert charge being good enough, especially given that Dr. Lippman testified that CSAS was not diagnostic. First, Dr. Lippman specifically tailored her testimony to reference Julie's purported intellectual difficulties. Second, saying that it's not diagnostic is not sufficient. Back in 2011, the model CSAS instruction provided that CSAS is only admissible for a limited purpose. It's not proof that abuse occurred. It is not a diagnostic device and cannot be used to determine whether abuse occurred. CSAS is not proof of a victim's credibility. And if I could quote from the charge, you may not consider the expert testimony as in any way providing the defendant committed any particular act of abuse. That was a far cry from the generic expert instruction that was given. So I'm going to leave the retroactivity issue to my colleagues and conclude on that point, unless there are particular questions as to why I believe, irrespective of the ultimate determination of retroactivity, reversal should be required in CK's case.
Thank you, Mr. Ventura, and thank you to the last three counsel for the very succinct arguments. Ms. Borden, I'm going to make that same invitation to you. You have a more ambitious issue to tackle with us, but try to keep it to 10 minutes if at all possible. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. The ACLU of New Jersey has urged you to consider and afford complete retroactivity to JLG. I'd like to actually focus on only 2 points today, and I hope my second one will be quite brief. My first point is a discussion of the retroactivity factors, and in particular, the significance of JLG's purpose. And the purpose, as we know, is the most pivotal factor in the analysis. And indeed, as we argue in our brief, it should be dispositive when it is to overcome the substantial impairment of the truth-seeking function. We argue here that it is indeed just that. JLG's ruling goes to the core of truth-seeking and accuracy of verdicts. CSAAS immunize witness testability from credibility challenges, and in so doing, really ease the state's burdens of proof by making those proofs effectively unassailable. If I may quote the court to itself, in JLG, you found, quote, the theory is not based on scientific data. It both proves too much and very little at the same time. It is not enough to state that certain behaviors can be observed in some victims some of the time, or that those behaviors are not inconsistent with abuse. That is not the type of, quote, state-of-the-art evidence the case law requires. And then, Chief Justice, you also cited another source that had called CSAAS junk science, and as Mr. Lesberg pointed out, the special master called it junk science as well. Now, this is not just any old junk science, of course. It's junk science dressed up in the garb of expertise, of expert testimony. And there, I'd like to just say that expert testimony really does have that extra character, that extra sort of dignified character. And I returned as I was preparing to speak to your honors to the model jury charges on expert testimony. And of course, that now with the new charge with respect to delayed disclosure should be read along with it. And that general jury charge reads that the value or instructs jurors, quote, that the value or weight of the opinion is dependent on and no stronger than the facts on which it is based. And then the instruction goes on to tell jurors that they must consider the facts of the time. The problem with CAS testimony in sort of immunizing the victim's testimony is that there are no underlying facts to consider, because this CAS evidence says you can take the facts as they are to mean she was abused, and it might also mean she wasn't. It sort of does both too little and too much at once. And in that sense, I'd like to return to the distinction of Henderson, because in Henderson, in applying it just prospectively, the court wrote that defendants had been able to challenge eyewitness testimony in the past under the Manson and Madison rules. Here, there was no way of challenging the witnesses, the victims' credibility, because CAS said it's really unassailable. Of course, your honors will know best what your purpose in JLG was, but the ACLU reads that purpose to be quite substantial, to go to truth-seeking and accuracy, and therefore we urge you to confirm that purpose by affording complete retroactivity. We join Mr. Lesberg in his analysis of factors 2 and 3. I'd like to just add a point to each. As the second factor on reliance, of course it will always be the case that the state has relied in good faith on the old rule. So that is sort of always the case whenever there is a new ruling to trigger a retroactivity analysis. Here, though, if anything, the reliance was less well placed. And that's for two reasons. Because first, as the appellate division recognized, the court's jurisprudence over the years had expressed some concern about the overbreadth of CAAS testimony. And secondly, because some defendants, including those here, actually challenged CAAS testimony, put on their separate experts, or spoke to the unreliability of it. So the state was on notice that its reliance was vulnerable, perhaps. As to the third factor, which is the administration of justice, I just point out, I think Mr. McNara confused or sort of combined a bit the idea of harmless error analysis and retrial. And so here, if your honors were to afford complete retroactivity, it is not the case that every single defendant would have to be retried. Rather, it would simply be that those who petitioned, right, many of whom may have already served their sentence to completion, those who petitioned would be entitled only to a harmless error review. And as we know from JLG itself, that review is not toothless. I would also say that, you know, to the extent the idea of administration of justice is about societal interest, certainly society has an interest in not overburdening the courts. Society also has an interest in not having wrongful convictions, in the accuracy of our jury verdicts. And so we would submit that even though this may be years later, for the same reason that in innocence work more broadly, we don't say, too bad, it's been too long. We really do think that it's important to revisit if your honors find that there was substantial impairment of the accuracy. If your honors don't have questions about the retroactivity factors, I would like to move on to my second point briefly.
I have a question about retroactivity. Just one question. Our prior cases apply new rules retroactively when there's been an egregious error, almost a fundamental flaw, like a shifting of the burden of the proof, not requiring proof beyond a reasonable doubt, the absence of the right to counsel, and so on. Does CSAAS testimony rise to that level?
We argue it does, Your Honor, and that's because it says the state's proofs, and in many of these cases, the victim is essentially the only or the principal proof, the state's proofs are unassailable. And that is effectively a shifting or at least a lessening of the burden of proof. So we do think it is that egregious. My second point briefly is that I believe the appellate division felt constrained by the posture of these four appeals to only consider pipeline retroactivity, and thus its finding that JLG is entitled to at least pipeline. Lest your honors consider dismissing my argument as improperly raised, I would like to just briefly touch on the three reasons that it is part of the question before you today. Reason one is that this is not an advisory opinion. Our request that you consider and afford complete retroactivity, the case and controversy before your honors as brought by these four defendants, is what, if any, degree of retroactive application to afford JLG. As we know from the case law, there are four possible options. It would contort, I submit, your honor's analysis to remove one of those options from the menu. I would just say that to the extent this does feel advisory, your honors are empowered to give such advice to the lower courts and to advocates, and you have done so in the past, for example, in Henderson, or to the extent we spoke about Koval earlier, to the extent Kane is read as going forward, its language of going forward is read to mean prospective application only. Your honors did it there as well as in numerous other cases we cite in our brief. The second reason that we urge your honors to consider and afford complete retroactivity is to avoid misinterpretation. Because the three factors must be analyzed even for a finding of pipeline retroactivity, if you were constrained to only look at pipeline or prospective, you would necessarily still be considering the purpose of the rule, and I would submit finding, as Mr. Lusberg has argued, an enhanced reliability purpose, because that is a lesser purpose than substantial impairment of the truth-seeking function. I fear that lower courts would point to the finding in denying complete retroactivity down the road. And so by dismissing my argument, I fear you would effectively decide the question. And that brings me to my final reason and our request of your honors. We believe that judicial economy counsels in favor of considering complete retroactivity today so that it is not raised by future petitioners down the line. If you decide not to consider complete retroactivity as one of the options, we urge you to do as the appellate division did and find that at a minimum, JLG is entitled to pipeline retroactivity, and therefore signal to the lower courts that you leave the question of complete retroactivity open for another day.
Thank you, Ms. Borden. Ms. Leonard, brief rebuttal, please.
Thank you, very briefly. I'll go first to the Chief Justice, your question about how this does not raise, and this is not an egregious error or a fundamental flaw. CSAAS testimony certainly does not rise to that level, certainly doesn't even rise to the level in Henderson, where this court acknowledged the possibility of wrongful convictions, but said there's always a possibility to challenge. And so I disagree with the ACLU there. Defense attorneys always have the opportunity to bring in defense experts to rebut the state's expert. And just to note that to Mr. Lusberg's point, at least CP and CK, and I'm sure the others too, these were years before JLG came out. Both of those were 2 years before. And so moving on to just a couple points in CP. I apologize. The point about there being no physical evidence in the case, that's almost always the case in these child sex assault cases, and that's tied in with the delay. But I disagree that the expert went outside of the scope. She mentioned statistics but didn't give statistics. And anything that Dr. Lippman testified about was then cured by the rebuttal in the with the defense expert. And then for CK, just a quick point about the intact hymen. We know that penetration is broadly defined. It doesn't have to be deep enough to rupture the hymen. I believe that was addressed at trial and has really no bearing on whether there was penetration. And then finally about the reasons that Mr. Vanjura listed of why the CSAAS expert charge was necessary. He listed the limited purpose, that it's not proof of abuse, it's not diagnostic, and it's not proof of the victim's credibility. All of those aspects were addressed in the expert charge, coupled with Dr. Lippman's own testimony about it not being diagnostic. And in fact, she also acknowledged that there were flaws in CSAAS as a theory. So for all of those reasons, the state asks this court to not only apply this case prospectively, but in the instance that you don't, that this court find that the use of the expert was not reversible in either case.
Thank you. Mr. McNamara, Mr. Kennedy, I'm going to follow Mr. Kennedy's lead and allow each of you 1 minute of rebuttal in view of the lateness of the hour. Mr. McNamara, please go ahead.
Your Honor, unless the court has a particular question regarding our argument, the state's prepared to submit.
Thank you. Mr. Kennedy. Can't hear you, Mr. Kennedy. If you're muted, please unmute.
Thank you for that reminder. I bet my wife I was going to do that, and in fact, I did. And so just in regards to the argument that the evidence violated pre-JLG case law, just note that there was no argument made at trial that the expert testimony in RP violated pre-JLG case law. There was no argument made at the appellate division, despite there being three briefs filed in the appellate division on this issue, that the testimony, the expert testimony, violated pre-JLG case law. So, and I also note that the state's expert was very careful, again, as I know in my opening, to say that his testimony was not predictive or diagnostic, could not be, and that he did not know the victim and didn't know anything about the facts of the case. And unless Your Honors have any questions, I'd like to leave it there.
Thank you. And I want to thank